international leading experts on U.S. welfare policy. And in particular, one of Bob Rubbermuffet's areas of expertise is how the labor supply of single female mothers changes in response to U.S. welfare policy. Right? Now, those of you who attended his talk on Tuesday also know that he's one of the top thinkers about income inequality and how that's been changing over the past 20 to 30 years. He's also done some really neat research on setting up an economic framework for thinking about how marriage and cohabitation and fertility decisions work, which is also something that some of you guys might be interested in asking him about later. So today he's going to talk to us about trends over the past 20 years in both poverty in the United States as well as programs aimed at alleviating poverty. What I want to encourage you guys to do is sort of have clarifying questions for the first 20 or 30 minutes. All right, so we have plenty of time afterwards where you guys can ask him specific questions about policies and U.S. policies and poverty. My PAM 2040 students, please limit the number of questions that are directly about the homework. I would appreciate that. And without further ado, Dr. Bob Muffet.
Okay, thanks. Okay, yeah, glad to be here and talk about something I've worked on for a long time as a professor of economics. And I got my PhD, ancient history, a long time ago, 1975, and in economics. I'm an economist, and my first job after getting out was not an academic job, not being a professor. My first job was working on a welfare program in Gary, Indiana. And I went out and actually lived in Gary. I don't know if any of you have ever been to Gary, but it's an interesting place. We were testing a negative income tax program. There were a number of tests of it to see how families would do if they were given a guaranteed income if they didn't work, but if they were also had a program structured that would give them work incentives at the same time. And I went out, was in Gary, and I interviewed families, and I had to go to the welfare department, and I also collected data through a survey, helped the survey takers collect data, and I saw what kind of answers they were giving to questions, and it was actually one of the most valuable educational experiences I've had. There's nothing like being out in the field and actually meeting welfare families and seeing how their lives evolve to understand the statistics when you go back to your office and get all that data and try to make sense out of it. So I began on that, and later I actually went to a non-academic research firm. It was back on the East Coast, and we analyzed the data. And it wasn't until several years later that I actually became an academic and became a professor. But I started off my kind of professional career, if you call it, not as a professor, but out there trying to understand welfare programs. I also, at that time, got very involved in Washington, discussions of welfare reform, which I've always found extremely valuable, because it's nice and easy for me as a professor to sit back in my office and think about how the welfare programs really should be structured and analyze my data and say, yeah, economic theory says we should have this kind of program. But then you go to Washington and talk to some Republican senators, and you talk to some of the other real, people who make the real decisions out there, and they have a different point of view on things. And one of the things I've tried to do ever since I gotten involved and was exposed to those Washington policymakers was try to take their arguments seriously. I have to say I really tried to do that. See where people are coming from and say, okay, does that make any sense? Can I agree with that at all? And then I go back, I'm an economist, so I go back to my economic models and my data and say, can I make sense out of the arguments that people are making? It kind of makes sense out of the things that Washington is actually doing, and trying to be here, maybe even like a scientist, kind of understand why Congress is passing the laws they're passing, trying to keep my own personal views a little bit at distance. So that's actually what I'm going to talk about today. I understand you've read Chapter 17 in Gruber's textbook on income distribution and welfare, and I understand you've read one of my papers on the negative income tax. that appeared in an economics journal. And so I have a presentation here, kind of a lecture that touches, kind of builds upon both of those things, that chapter 17 and my paper. And it builds on it in the sense that I'm going to kind of assume you've read that and at least got all the basic stuff out of that already. And so mine is kind of, my lecture here is kind of a commentary on that or follow up and making some of the same points in a slightly different way, but very much closely related to it. So as Professor Owens said, please feel free to interrupt me as we go along if there's something in particular you don't understand that I have up on the screen. But I am intentionally not planning to talk the whole time. I'm going to end fairly early, and you can ask me questions about anything related to welfare and income redistribution, poverty, and even if it's not directly on what I'm going to talk about here. Yeah, there went.
I have a question about your talking about being in Washington.
Yeah.
So senators and reps usually have, I guess, short-term goals. They're only in term for 2 to 6 years, whereas if you want a welfare policy to really take long, it's going to take, I assume, a lot longer than 2 to 6 years.
Yeah.
I'm wondering whether or not in your experience, you found that politicians are more concerned with short-term goals rather than long-term goals, which could have greater impact.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a danger in all the political process of the short-term goals of the senators and even more so the representatives who only have two-year terms. Having said that, first of all, 6 years as a Senate term is a rather long period of time, at least to see something more than an immediate impact. Second thing is most of these guys and women are part of a party, and they are under some pressure to maintain a platform that will maintain that party in power for more than their own term. And most of them are trying to face great pressure to stay to the party line. So that's a slightly longer, the party obviously is interested in longer than their individual term. Most of the members of the House of Representatives don't only serve two terms. They serve a long time, and a lot of them serve a lot longer than senators, much longer than 6 years, 10, 15 years. So. While there's definitely an issue there, I think now the arguments plus these people make are not short-term arguments. Now they may be, you know, dissembling a little bit, but they're making arguments about what's long-term in the best interest of the poor. But certainly there's some element to that. Any other? Okay. So what do I have here? Okay, I have one point to make at the beginning about how economists study welfare reform and income redistribution. I would say it's difficult. This is not an easy topic for an economist to study. And for an economist, topics which are highly politicized and highly, where there are strong ideologies and strong political views, make it difficult. I call that a difficult topic. It's a lot easier to study the demand for pork bellies in Southern California, which no one really cares about. But if you study this, people have strong political views, and it's hard to get through to the, I would call the science, than some other topics in economics. We all have our personal preferences and values, and I have my own. And I, as an economist who works on this area, I try very hard to overcome my own views and put those at a distance and try to be as best I can as a neutral economist. Now, you can never do that, and one's own views inform the things you look at and the questions you ask and the particular aspects of that. And I would never pretend that I am completely neutral or that any economist is, but you know, it's a goal that one should try to achieve. Now, having said that, want to make one very important distinction here in the way economists, most economists work on these topics, and that's making a distinction between ends, there we go, ends and means to an end, an old distinction. And as economists, we often say that we shouldn't take a position on the ultimate ends. Okay, in a democracy, that's up to the majority of the voters. And I'm going to give you an example of an issue here in welfare reform that I would say is an ultimate end. As an economist, I have nothing to say about that. And if voters want to do that, fine. So be it. But we can say, if society's ends are X, if their ultimate ends, if the voters decide that they want to do X, then I can, as an economist, say, okay, this is the way you should do that. Program Y. Here's the best way to achieve that end. And sometimes it's a little difficult to distinguish between real ends and means to an end. For example, suppose your ultimate end is to reduce poverty among children or to improve the life chances for children. That sounds like kind of an ultimate end, and I think actually probably everybody would say they want to do that. Conservatives, liberals, everybody. But exactly how do you do that? And you do that by telling the mothers they have to go to work, or you do it by improving educational chances, maybe asking mothers to stay at home and taking care of their kids instead of asking mothers to work. That would be a means to an end. So, and there might be reasonable disagreement about that. So I'm going to try to make that distinction here, and I'm going to take this point of view. I'm going to go and say, here are some things that the government has done. And I'm going to say, what did it look like the ultimate ends really were here? Were they getting at a means to an end? Were they trying to do something and maybe do it the wrong way? Or are they trying to just do something different than maybe some other people wanted to? Which is it an end or a means to an end? So I'm going to take the second approach about trying to look at means to an end, separate the two, and with a slightly different angle. And what I'm going to do, as Professor Owen says, I'm going to look at the past 20 years of major welfare reforms in the income redistribution system, and I'm going to see if I can make any sense out of those changes with our economic models, the models that are in Gruber and in my paper. And I'm going to see, does it look like this is a means to any end that would make sense? And can I rationalize it at least in some way or another as being a reasonably valid point of view, a valid thing to do? So I'm not going to actually repeat and review the Gruber Chapter 7 or my paper, but I'm going to, you'll see if you've read all those, you'll see there'll be some very close connections, and I'm going to touch on some of the same arguments, and I will do a little bit of repetition of things that are in one of those two readings. Okay, so first of all, a little bit of review here, and when you study welfare programs in the U.S., you have to learn a bunch of different initials and acronyms, and I'm trying to keep that to at least a minimum. But there are three here that I really do want to mention. One is called TANF. Now that is mentioned in both of the readings, so I'm assuming you know that. Temporary Assistance for Needy Families. It used to be called AFDC. It's the main cash program that's for poor, mainly single mothers. It's really, if you read the law, what the law says about this program is the cash should go to any family where the children are deprived of the support of at least one of their parents. So the law says there has to be one parent missing. And if one parent is missing, then that family is maybe eligible. And they also have to be poor and have low income, low assets, and other things. But the major thing is they have to have one natural parent missing. And there are lots of gaps and holes in that. For example, if a woman has a child and the real father is not living there, but some other man is, then they're eligible for welfare because the natural father is not in the household. So there's been some issues about that. A lot of family of women on this program, TANF, actually are cohabiting with men, or they've even remarried men, and those men are natural. But it's a bit of a policy issue. I'm not going to talk about this, but you can imagine if that's the rule for the program, and they know that if they go and find the father of their children and say, come live with me now and let's get married, and they know they're going to lose all their benefits because they'll be no longer eligible for the program, they might think twice about doing that. So that's an old problem. It's not one I'm going to talk about, but we'd be happy to talk about it in the discussion period. So that's one of them that I will talk about a lot. It's this TANF program. The EITC, which stands for Earned Income Tax Credit, which is also mentioned in both of the readings, so I'm assuming you know that one, is what's called an earning subsidy. And I'll talk a little bit more about that, but as you, I'm sure you know, that program is a program for our federal government that through the tax system gives money to families who have some earnings. So you have to be working and earning some money. And if you do that, when you file your tax return every year in April, they'll send you a check back in proportion to the amount of annual earnings you've had. And it's going to be a very important program, and it's probably the most important in terms of dollars, in terms of number of people supported, probably now the number one program covering for income redistribution in the U.S. SSI, you may not have really seen that this acronym yet, stands for Supplemental Security Income. And that program provides dollars, cash, for families that are either have a disabled head family, or for elderly families that are poor, low income and assets. It is the main program for people who are just are low income. We have other disability programs in the U.S. That support the disabled under different eligibility conditions. This is a very important program, and I'll refer to it because it has a particular rationale, namely particularly disability, that's different than the rationale for the other programs. So all three of those give cash. And then, and I know you've also studied these other programs here, the in-kind, and we have programs for many different kinds of in-kind benefits. The most important in terms of number of families and benefits is the Medicaid program. It provides medical benefits, so poor families can go to the doctor, and the doctor, if they participate in the Medicaid program, will give them medical care at either free or at a heavily subsidized rate. All states do this, and a very important program. Been around since 1965. The food stamp program provides food coupons to families, low-income families. That program is very important. And in fact, today, food stamps is very important in the current recession. With the unemployment rate very high, the food stamp rolls have really skyrocketed. Not only are the poor receiving food stamps, but many of the families that are just unemployed, have been unemployed for 6 months or a year, are getting food stamps. You don't have to be long-term poor to be eligible for food stamps. If you're a middle-class family and you've been laid off and you haven't been unemployed for a year, your income's low enough to qualify for food stamps. And it's a great help to the unemployed to be able to get it. At least it covers food. So that's a very important program. We have housing programs, which are somewhat smaller. We have two kind of programs there. There are programs for public housing. If you're poor, you can apply to get an apartment in a public housing project. They'll subsidize your rent, give you a very low rent. So if you live in New York City, where the rents are astronomical, you can get into public housing. They'll give you an apartment at a much lower rent than the market requires. So, but the other type of housing program we have is one where you get a voucher, and you may have not understand vouchers, but you are told you can go out and find your own apartment anywhere in the city. And you find one, and once you find it, there'll be a rent. We'll then either pay you directly, like 50% of that rent, or we'll pay your landlord that 50%, one or the other, but we'll subsidize your rent. So again, that's an in-kind program. And then we have a lot of child care programs where you specifically subsidize child care. So one of the things to say right off the bat about cash versus in-kind is that if you scratch your average economist, the average economist, and not those of us who work on these programs, because we have a different point of view on this, but if you talk to your other economists, they're always going to say all programs should be cash, and that's the better way to give money to people. Don't tell them what they have to spend. Don't tell them you have to spend your money on medical care, or you have to buy food or housing, child. Let them spend it on whatever they want to, and just trust those parents to spend it on what they think is right. If they want to spend it on something else, fine. Hope that they are acting in the best interest of themselves and their children. And as I'm going to say here, and as you've read my paper already, you know that the public doesn't agree with that. and Congress doesn't agree with that, and the trend is just in the opposite direction from that. So I'll talk a bit more about that and repeat some of the things I say in my article and some of the things that Gruber says about why the public out there seems to really like these in-kind programs better. It's not that not much of a rocket science to figure out why they would probably prefer to do that. Okay, so I said what I'm going to do here, and the way I kind of got the hook I'm going to hang these economic, as an economist, my talking about economic models, the hook I'm going to hang it on is to talk about five changes that have happened over the past 20 years and try to analyze each one with economic model. So one of them is that EITC program. I'm just going to talk about it. You know, it was introduced, exactly introduced a long time ago, but it really has this big, big growth in the late 1980s and early 1990s. That's when it really started. And three reform changes that were made in that TANF program. One of them is the reduction of this tax rate on work, the work incentive issue, which I talk about. President Owens referred to that, work incentives. It's in Gruber. That's the traditional topic that all economists have always been interested in. How do you give work incentives to people on welfare? These things called work requirements, which you've read about, assume, and also the something called time limits. And I don't know if you have, if they talked about time limits, maybe mentioned them, but not in detail. I didn't talk about that much in my article that you read, and Gruber, I looked at Gruber, and he didn't have a whole lot on that either. So, but that is actually a very important reform that was out talked about a lot in the press and the media and Congress and Washington. So I do want to talk about that one. And then this last one I've already referred to, I'm not going to spend very much time on it, but why we've had some big increases in the in-kind programs rather than cash. So I'll just come back and talk for a second about that one again. Okay, so what about the earned income tax credit? It is covered in your Gruber Chapter 17 in my NIT, Negative Income Tax, article. And it's a very popular program among economists and pretty popular out there in the political sphere, too. Economists like it because, as I said, their main focus is always on work incentives. And it is a program where you provide work incentives, at least for the people at the very bottom. The very lowest income workers get a positive work incentive from the program. Unlike the negative income tax, which I didn't exposit here, but you've done the budget constraints and the indifference curves, the negative income tax. And the negative income tax is a program that gives money, first of all, to people who don't work, and then it tries to have low work disincentives for the poor. But a negative income tax has work disincentives because as you work more, your benefit from the welfare program falls. There's no question that your benefit falls if you work more under a negative income tax or any kind of welfare program. And if your benefit falls as you work more, that's a work disincentive. So the only issue with a negative income tax is how do we minimize those work disincentives and try to make sure they're not too large. And if we have a 100% tax rate so that as you work more, you lose, you know, you work earn $100 and they just reduce your welfare benefit by $100, that's kind of the worst disincentive of all. So in the negative income tax, you say let's have a lower tax rate than that, at least have some work disincentives. So maybe if I work earn $100, they only reduce my benefit by $50, and so at least I'm $50 ahead of the game. But there's still work disincentives. In the EITC, if you earn $100, you keep your whole $100, and you get like $40 more on top of that. So it's actually a work incentive. You get more than you initially earned, and you don't get some reduction, some takeaway from how much you earned. So that's the appeal of the program and why it's so popular among economists. Now, having said that, Gruber, one of the things, I actually like the Gruber book a lot, and one of the reasons I like it is because unlike a lot of textbooks, he actually talks about what the magnitudes of some of the effects are. How big are the work incentives of these programs? And most of the economists like me who work on this, that's actually what we spend 90% of our time doing, not dreaming up the best welfare program in the world or analyzing what the best design is. We should spend 90% of our time crunching data and analyze the data to try to figure out what the real magnitudes of some of these numbers are. Because the magnitudes actually matter. And it turns out, and this is my own view, so not everyone else, I try to always say when not everybody, other economists agree with me, but the work incentives of the EITC are not that huge. They're non-trivial, and it's very important to get work incentives out of any program. But the initial subsidy rate in the EITC is about 40%. So for some families, if you earn that $100, you get $40 extra. That's a huge work incentive. Out of that, if you look at single mothers, who are the major group here, you get like a 5% increase in labor supply and work interest, something like that. The studies show 5%. Now 5% is actually a big number. To get increase in 5% in the labor supply of single, when we spent years trying to figure out how to get more work, how to get single mothers to work, is non-trivial. So I don't want to dismiss it at all. On the other hand, we're spending about $45 billion on this program, and you're spending $45 billion to get a 5% increase in the labor supply of low-income single mothers. Now, I don't know, you can tell me if that, you think that's worth it. I don't think that it is, and I don't think you can justify this program just on the basis of work incentives. And in fact, the political people do not justify it just on the basis of work incentives. In fact, if you go to Congress and see the politicians who support this program, a lot of times they never talk about work incentives. So what do they talk about? What they talk about is that it provides benefits to the working poor. And I have the diagram reproduced here, which is just taken from my, so this is taken straight from my article that you've read. And it shows this diagram that's in Gruber and all economists work with, where you work more and you earn more. So this line AE is how much you earn more if you don't have any program. The EITC increases your income if you work more in the beginning. Then it has this flat region, and then it eventually phases out. So where's the money going here? The money is going to people who work. It doesn't give any money to somebody who doesn't work. And it gives a little bit of money to people who earn a little bit. But it gives a lot of money to these people in here. And who are those people? I should have put it on my slide, this word, the working poor. I didn't put it on my slide. But you see this word term, the working poor, discussed in Washington all the time. And what are the working poor? The people who are working. A lot of them, families are working full-time, so 50 weeks a year, 30 to 40 hours a week. But their wage rates are so low, and their jobs are so poor, and their skills are so bad, they are still below the government poverty line, even after doing that. They're called the working poor. And when the EITC was greatly expanded in the late 80s, 1990s, that's the reason that policymakers wanted to support this program. Let's give some money to the working poor, to those families who are quote-unquote playing by the rules. They're out there working, they're not sitting at home, and yet they're still below the poverty line. Let's make sure we have a program which gives them some income support. If it doesn't raise them above the poverty line, it at least gets them closer to it. Now that has nothing to do with work incentives. Suppose nobody, you had this program, nobody changed the hours of work or how much they work at all. It has nothing to do with it. But you are achieving this goal of giving more money to those people who are working. Now that's very important because it's been a general trend here in the U.S. that there's been a greater interest in supporting the working poor, and relatively speaking, a less interest in supporting the people at the very bottom who aren't working. Good question.
I just wonder, what other incentive could you give to a poor person that increase the wage? Mm-hmm. Increase their wages, more likely.
Yeah.
Why is that they don't follow, they don't try to pursue a policy of just increasing the way that the working poor?
Uh-huh. Well, this program doesn't do that. It just gives them earning subsidy. So if you want to increase their wage rate, there are two different ways to do that. One is to actually directly have the government go in and increase the hourly wage that a person receives on a job. Those are called wage rate subsidies. So if somebody's working at a job and they're being paid, they report, or their employer reports they're being paid $10 an hour, the government comes in and bumps that up to $12 an hour. The longer term goal is to increase their skills and their education, and as we say in economics, their human capital, so that when they go out, they have higher skills and the employer will pay them more because they're a higher skilled worker. So those are very good programs. On the education and human capital side, the evidence there is that that's kind of tough. We haven't found you can improve the schools. You can have training programs, which take poor families and give them more training. And we found programs like training programs that modestly increase people's wages that they can get out on the labor market. Again, by about, you know, maybe even up to 10% increase in their hourly wage rates they can give if you train them. So, and of course, there's been lots of education reforms, which is a whole other area. But I think everyone would prefer that. Those are just more difficult, but equally worthy of pursuing. So, was there another question up the top? Yeah. Oh, okay, go ahead. Yeah. Doesn't matter.
In regards to human capital.
Yeah.
In regards to human capital.
Yeah.
In terms of, I guess, increasing it. If there's a poor family and they have a child, more likely their child will be poor in the future. So I guess it's important to increase human capital. But what type of incentives is there for a parent to enroll his or her child into, I guess, a school that provides more a higher quality education and will give them a higher income than their parents?
Well, most schooling today is still public education, so and most families send their kids to the neighborhood school still. So I don't think there's a lot that parents can do about it. A lot of parents would prefer to do more about it. So right now, I think the one of the things that economists and other sociologists have discussed is trying to encourage parents to give more home. Kind of read to their children, to do educational things at home with their children, and there's a big research literature on whether that would has any effect or not, but I think a lot of people are very much in support of that. But short of that, without a change, a pretty considerable change in the educational system, parents really have no way of improving the education that their children receive. The educational reforms that a lot of economists and other political policymakers are trying to achieve. There's one group that wants to try for more competition, like educational vouchers, where a family can get a piece of paper and take their child to any school in the area, including a private school. And there are a lot of people who believe that will enable parents to put their kids into better schools than their neighborhood school. There are charter schools, which are now fairly popular, and you can take your kid out of the public school and put him into a charter school if you think that is important. Actually, charter schools and private and parochial schools are pretty important in a lot of low-income neighborhoods already. Believe it or not, in a lot of low-income communities, neighborhoods in the U.S., a lot of low-income families send their children to Catholic schools, and Catholic schools don't charge that much. And they think a better education in the Catholic, not because they're Catholic, because they and the Catholic schools don't, you don't have to be Catholic to go to Catholic school. A lot of low-income families use those. But I think overall, the educational system very much constrains what parents can do, which is a hotly debated question, and lots of proposals for changing that. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned that it was about increasing future skills. So why don't we try to link welfare to mandatory school attendance? Or there are some countries that do that already.
We do that. Our welfare program, this TANF program, does require that. That was one of the I wasn't going to talk about that reform. But if you're receiving benefits from the TANF program, if you yourself, if the mother is below 18, she has to attend school, and she'll be cut off from the welfare program if she doesn't. And her children, if they were below 18, they have to attend school. And there's an elaborate system for the school reporting to the welfare department, and what's a legitimate absence if they're sick or doctor's note or something like that. But yeah, we have that. The only problem is that this TANF program, as I'm going to show you, and you may know, already, the number of families on it has really dropped. And so you're not getting to all those millions of low-income families that aren't on the program.
You mentioned that EITC, like the amount of incentives that it provides, it's kind of small for like the amount of money that we spend on the program.
Uh-huh.
But is there another program that's like maybe getting a bigger return than 5%? Is there?
Yeah, I'll show you one. I mean, this TANF reform will do that, but I don't think we found a program like this where you just subsidize. Now, we haven't done some of these wage subsidy programs that might give bigger incentives, but I think what you have to understand is that, so the answer is no. I'm not going to give you any program that's going to give you a whopping good, and that's the $64,000 question. If we could find that, we'd be in great shape, and if it didn't cost a fortune. What you have to keep in mind, that particularly here, if you think about single mothers, that's not the only group we're talking about here. There's a lot of low-income married couples too, husband and wives. But they have a lot of problems other than just how much money they're going to get out there. They've got childcare to deal with. They've got transportation to deal with. How they're going to get to those jobs? They don't have cars. They're going to have to take the bus across town. They're going to have jobs which might be evening jobs or overnight jobs or off-peak jobs. They have health problems. Their kids have health problems that make them miss work a lot. They have a lot of kind of barriers, to work. And if you just increase the amount they get paid as economists, yeah, we know that's going to help some of them. But some of them, that's just not enough to overcome all these other problems they have with working, and it's only going to make a small dent in it. So it's a complex problem, and we try to attack it in pieces, but there are many different aspects to it. Yeah?
Professor, why don't you change this program for some kind of non-employment insurance program where you guarantee an income? Because the way I see this program, we're not just subsidizing the poor, we were subsidizing McDonald's, because they get to keep their wages low. Mm-hmm. Because these people are willing to take this job. If they didn't have this income and they had a secured income, McDonald's will have the pressure to increase their wages so that they could get a workforce.
Uh-huh. Well, that's been looked at a little bit, and that's only partially true. The question would be with McDonald's is, can they pay a lower wage because they know that these recipients have to work or want to work to keep their welfare benefits? And the answer is yes, unless some other employer comes along, like Walmart, and says, we'll hire you for a little bit higher wage. It's only true if McDonald's is the only one of the few employers that these welfare recipients can work at, and if there's no competition in the labor market from other employers who will be willing to pay a higher wage. Now, in fact, if you go to low-income neighborhoods, sometimes McDonald's is the only place they can work, so there's a little bit of that. I think that the major problem is not really the employers lowering the wages. I think the problem is getting employers to pay higher wages in general. As you may know, by the way, Obama, I wasn't going to talk a lot about Obama, but if you've been reading the news in the last 3 days, he's finally persuaded the U.S. Senate to pass a jobs bill to try to attack the unemployment problem in the United States. Now, it's not solely focused on the poor. It's focused on the unemployed, and there are a lot of middle-class unemployed workers right now. But his proposal, the centerpiece of his proposal, is what's called a jobs tax credit. And what that jobs tax credit is it tells employers that if you hire a person who's been unemployed for at least X months, so somebody who's been unemployed for at least 2, 3, 4 months, that if you hire them, we will, and let's say you hire them at $10 an hour, we, the government, will go to your employer and increase, give you an extra pot of money as a percentage of that hourly wage. So if they, you hire somebody $10 an hour, we'll give you like a 20% increase, like a $2 an hour more for however many hours that worker, we have that hour worker work. And that's precisely to try to increase the wage rate that employers receive and get them to hire people. That's the problem in the recession. It's also a problem in low-income communities is getting employers to hire workers that they feel, and they may be wrong, but they may feel can't produce enough to meet the wage they have to pay, so they're not going to hire them. But if you subsidize, so those have also been tried in the past. They're not always that easy to implement, but that's another longstanding program out there for trying to get firms, employers to hire low-skilled workers, as well as unemployed workers in general. Okay, Professor Burkhalter. Yeah, well, as an economist, and as most economists are actually opposed to both minimum wages and mandatory living wages. Living wage refers to a mandate that all employers have to pay at least a certain wage. And a living wage refers to a wage that allows a family actually to be at the poverty line if they work full time and make a decent standard of living. There are actually a number of living wage laws out there right now, including my home city of Baltimore. The city of Baltimore has a very high living wage, and it mandates that all employers who do business with the city of Baltimore have to pay at least a certain wage. The problem with that is that you're forcing employers to pay a higher wage than they are getting from in terms of production from that worker. So you're forcing them to reduce their profits. And it'd be nice if we could reduce profits and take away profits from all the employers and give it to the poor in some way. But the problem is you can't force employers to do that. If you just to do that, what's to stop them from just not hiring any of those workers anymore and reducing their employment? Or moving to a different city or offshoring their employment. It would be much better to subsidize their employment and have the government say, okay, we'll pay you 20% more on top of that hourly wage, and that will give them an incentive to hire more people instead of mandating. But the government pays for it. The problem is there's not a whole lot of just money just sitting around. I mean, we read about Wall Street firms and all their cash, and yeah, can't we grab some of that cash and get it to some people we want to, like the poor? Walmart, believe it or not, and they make a good profit, but they don't have a whole lot of money just sitting around to just transfer all those profits to their workers, and it's very difficult to force them to do that. It's not the way most economists believe. That's not the right way to get money from high-income people to low-income people. We all typically believe the way to get money from high-income people to low-income people is not to try to force employers to do that through the workplace, but to use the tax system to tax high-income people and get that money to the low-income people in terms of wage subsidies, if you want to spend it on that, or in terms of welfare programs or some other kind of program. So, yeah, I'll set some questions on that. Let's start here. Yeah. But why is there little formal employment? There's little formal employment, because employers don't want to go in there, and they don't think these workers are good workers. So they're not, they think that person is worth maybe less than minimum wage work. That's how much they would produce, and I can't pay the minimum wage. Don't want to pay the minimum wage. But if you said, okay, the government will pay you, a lot more if you'll hire that person. They're really only producing $5 an hour worth of product, but we'll give you an extra, $3. Go ahead and hire them anyway. That might. There's actually a little bit of a literature on some of these programs do work if you go into low-income neighborhoods and give tax subsidies to employers to go into that neighborhood and hire people. It's called enterprise zones in urban areas. So it's another angle. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Professor, if we're talking about redistribution, right, and get money from the rich to the poor, which is actually what I understand, the simplistic understanding behind it.
Uh-huh.
And you said correctly, I think, that if we tax the higher income people, we give that money to the lower income people, that will work. But the problem is we're not. The problem is that the total revenue of the country, only 14% of that comes from big business.
Uh-huh.
And the burden has been shifted to the income tax, to the payroll tax.
Uh-huh.
So
yeah.
Actually, we have a redistribution system right now that redistributes the money from the low income to the high income. they don't pay anything. I think that we either have to reconsider our tax policy and start taxing the higher income,
yeah,
or change the unemployment system.
Well, so there are a bunch of issues there. One of them is taxing businesses versus taxing households. And it's very popular to tax businesses instead of households. At least a lot of people prefer that. Economists' point of view on that is businesses are owned by people. And if you tax a business, if you're trying to really tax the person who owns that, why not just go and tax the person and not the company? If you tax a company, again, the only problem with trying to go after firms directly is you can't control them. Unless we're in a a Soviet Russia economy where the government can actually tell a firm what to do, how much to produce, how much to hire. If you allow in a private market system, employers to do what they do, you try to do something to employers, and they get around it by doing something else. You know, they try to escape it. If you tax them, what are they going to do if you tax them? It'd be nice if you could force them to just take the money out of their pocket and give it to the government and not change their employment or their prices or anything else. But suppose they said, okay, I'm just going to raise my prices, the consumers. Now who gets hurt? You know, the consumers out there are paying, you know, for this tax on the firms, not the firms. They're going to keep their profits just what they were. So it's just really hard to force employers to do what they do. That's why just going directly to the firm. Now, the tax system in the U.S. has gotten a lot less progressive. If we go back, 50 years ago, we had higher marginal tax rates on the high income, and we slowly eroded that. It began really in the late 70s and under Ronald Reagan's presidential administration, and has continued since then. America, I have to say, is pretty unique in this. We're one of the most conservative countries of all. Developed countries, if you go to Europe, they still have some pretty much higher marginal tax rates on higher income families than we do. But we've evolved in this very anti-tax society, which we may not like, but it's clearly something those voters, they may not be rational voters. So that's, I would never claim they are, but certainly that's the evidence. And so we still have a slightly progressive system, but it's not very progressive. So that's something it's hard to deal with. Huh?
A lot of city governments in order to entice businesses to come in, say like a Walmart, given these huge tax breaks.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But it's a huge amount that's just not in the budget whatsoever.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Well, like I said, I think local economic development is really difficult. And another problem with local economic development is that you get in this position where different local governments are competing with one another for business. So somebody promises Walmart, a 10% break, and then the next one say, okay, I'll make it 12, and the neighboring city, okay, I'll have to 13, and then you get into this race between neighboring governments to try to see how big a tax break you can give to Walmart. So there's a big question there. All I was saying is that there's a research evidence on this, and it says if you do give tax breaks to people like Walmart, they actually do hire a little bit more. I don't remember the numbers, so it's, again, the quantitative magnitudes, are important here, whether it's enough to try to find that amount of money for however much increase in employment you get. But it does have at least some positive effect. But there are certainly there are issues with those kind of programs, so many different kind of issues.
But I wonder if it's actually equal in that the amount of tax breaks that they're getting and then what they're actually paid wages, I guess, that they're giving to the labor force, and then
uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I wish I knew the research evidence on that, because I always like to say, and I don't know that one very well. Okay, well, let me go ahead and just make a few more points here about that I was going to make, which is about the EITC. I believe that This earned income tax credit is a reflection of a general trend among voters, because I think, you know, I'm old-fashioned. I believe that Congress actually represents the voters, and we see Congress do something, and I actually think they're doing it because now the voters, you know, whether they're, like I said, whether they're rational or not, I don't know. But I think the voters have gotten in this idea they want to help people who work. And they've gotten this idea they don't really, you know, I'm not sure they like people who don't work very much anymore. So this is one, the fact that we have this big earned income tax program that funnels all this money to the working poor, billions of dollars, and nothing. If you don't work, you get nothing out of this program. If you have these barriers, you have health problems, if you can't find childcare, or if you can't work at all, you don't get anything out of this program. So it doesn't, which is fine. You know, you can have one program to help those people who are really at the bottom, and a different program to help the working poor. And if we had that, that would be fine. But that's a long-term trend, which I'm going to mention again. We've discussed this increase in the negative income tax, where you try to give the work incentives, where if you're on welfare, you work more, and you get your benefit reduced. The negative income tax tries to not reduce it too much. But again, not everybody can take advantage of that. A lot of single mothers have real barriers. So where's the, you know, you've seen this diagram. This is the diagram in my paper, but there's one in Gruber's textbook. So the negative income tax has this dotted line so that if you work more, in the old days, you got all your earnings taken away from you, but now under a negative income tax, you earn less. Well, where do the biggest benefits go? The benefit is the distance between this solid line and the dotted line. Well, if you started off at CD, that was the old welfare program, then now the benefits increase. So the biggest benefits are all right in the middle here. In other words, the people who are working some significant amount. So a negative income tax, yeah, some people will go out maybe from who weren't working before, and will maybe move out to that area, so they'll now get a nice big positive benefit. But a lot of people were working there already, and they were already working that number of hours. So once again, a negative income tax subsidizes workers, okay? And if you actually count the bucks go a lot more to people who were working already than the number of people who are induced to work. So it goes along with the same thing as EITC. Let's help the people who work. I'm not, again, it's great for work incentives, and some people are induced to work by this, so that's a great positive. These work requirements, which are discussed in Gruber and in my paper, is a big reform, and the way they work is you have to go to the poor and divide them into who can work and who can't work, and that's a very difficult thing to do, and that's the major problem with work requirements. However, they have one advantage, and that is that and this is discussed in Gruber and in my paper a little bit, but Gruber makes it very explicit. He calls it a, where is it here? He calls it the Iron Triangle. And the Iron Triangle that Gruber refers to is illustrated by that graph. Where was that graph of the negative income tax? Yeah. What he's referring to is the following. Suppose you want a welfare program which pays a nice benefit to the people who don't work. And suppose you say you would like to, and suppose you think most of those people who don't work or really can't work. So like I said, suppose you have this kind of can't work and can work. Now the world doesn't divide neatly into that category. Suppose the can't work are these women with health problems, you know, with a very significant commutes, or in an area where there are almost no jobs, so they have real significant barriers to work. And suppose they're down there, you want to say, okay, those people really can't, I really want to give them money at least to raise them up to the official government poverty line. So let's give them $15,000 a year for a family of four, which is about what the government poverty line is right now. So you want to, you know, make them not poor, you think they can't work. And at the same time, however, you want to give decent workers, well, some people can work. And we want to make sure that if they go out to work, they make more money, they don't lose all their money by doing that. So we have a negative income tax. So what's a good tax rate? Well, a good tax rate, what would be a nice low tax rate? Well, a nice low tax rate, I think, would be around 20%. Why do I think that? Because that's what's in a positive income tax. Right now, a positive income tax starts off at about between 15 and 20%. If you're really low income, you don't pay any taxes to the government income tax. Then it goes up to about 20%. And then it rises up, and right now the top official bracket is like 33 to 35%. So that's the kind of range. I mean, you don't want to impose a higher tax rate. And people complain about that. I mean, you talk to the middle class families, they're bitter about this 25 to 30% marginal tax rate they have to pay to the US government every April, you know? So if you impose a 50% tax rate on the low income families, you're saying, okay, well, you know, our middle class people only have to pay 25% in the income tax, but you're a welfare recipient, you have to pay 50% because that's how much we're, it seems like a high, they're gonna say there's a high tax rate, taking away half of their money. So I would say a reasonable tax rate would be the same rate, you know, middle class people have to pay in the income tax, 25%. Well, if you say, okay, this is Gruber's iron triangle problem. If you pay the people who can't work up to the poverty line, and then you set, say, a 25% marginal tax rate here, then mathematically you can calculate what the top income point is where people will receive benefits. And the mathematical formula says it is for 25%, 1 over 0.25 is 4. 4 times that amount down here, which is the poverty line, 4 times the poverty line is the mathematical formula. So if you set the guarantee at the poverty level and you set a 25% marginal tax rate, then you're going to pay benefits, people all the way up the income distribution, to 4 times the poverty line. So if you set the guarantee down there at $15,000 a year, you're going to pay people up to $60,000 a year. You're going to pay them welfare benefits. So in the process of trying to be good to the non-work people who can't work and simultaneously trying to have a low tax rate to encourage the people who can work to work, you have to pay benefits way up to the middle class, which doesn't make sense from a, you know, income. We're trying to help the poor here. And so that's it's a mathematical law, a triangle. So, and what's the popular appeal about work requirements? You solve the problem. You just cut the Gordian knot, it solves it. And the way you solve it is saying, okay, I'm gonna try to figure out who can't work and who can work. And if I think somebody can't work, I'm gonna give them the poverty line benefit. But if somebody can't work, I'm not gonna give them anything, or at least give them a little really low guarantee, but I'm not gonna give you anything if you can't work. I'll give you a nice low marginal tax rate. And I won't have it go up to $60,000 a year. I'll have it cut off somewhere below that. And that you can do that because you're not having to pay them that poverty line. So by separating the groups, you solve this iron triangle problem that Gruber was talking about. What's the downside? The downside is how you tell who can work and can't work. And it's not even sure you can define what you mean by that. I've listed some things that might be criteria for that, like having a severe health problem. Might be a criteria for that. My personal belief as an economist is that you can do it pretty well. If you work hard at it, if the government really talks to people and tries to find out their situation and spends the effort to really find out where they really have barriers, they can do a decent job. But if you do a really bad job of it, then you're going to really screw things up. And the way you're going to screw things up is you're going to make mistakes. And that means you're going to be a lot of people out there who really can work, and you think they can't, and you're going to end up giving them a lot of money, which they don't really deserve because they could work. And there are going to be a lot of people who can't work, and you make a mistake thinking they can, and you're going to say, you got to work 30 hours a week. And then they're going to be in big trouble, and probably what they're going to do is they won't be able to work 30 hours a week, and then they're going to lose, they're going to be kicked off welfare because the rule has to, for a work requirement has to be that you get kicked off if you don't work 30 hours a week. The consensus among the experts who work on welfare reform and hang around Washington and hang around the welfare office out there, is the government right now is doing a terrible job at distinguishing people who can work. I mean, they just don't care. You go into your caseworker, and caseworker kind of makes a flip decision, and every caseworker kind of does it off the seat of their pants, and it's just really a bad system. So I have a hard time citing studies for that, but that's really the feeling out there. Okay, let me move on. The time limits, I'll just mention briefly, you haven't really discussed those, but those are the very controversial. And the law is that right now, no woman can receive benefits for more than five years of her entire lifetime. If you have 5 years and you use that up, forget it. For the rest of your life, you can never receive another dollar. There are lots of kind of loopholes and exceptions to that, but that's the rule. That one, economists have a really hard time coming up with a model that will. That's the one. All these others I've talked about, there's at least an economic model that could rationalize it. This one, economists have not, you know, the only model for which you could ever conceive of this, if you think people aren't really permanently poor, that they have like a temporary bad year, and then they come back, you know, eventually to being fine again. And most people who study poverty know that, you know, families have long-term problems, and it's a lifetime problem. There's a modification of this which is a little bit better. Like the state of Massachusetts has a program, because they use their own money, because the federal government won't do this. They say you can receive benefits for 3 out of every 5, which means you have to go off welfare for 2 years. And if you go off welfare for 2 years, you can come back, and then you're eligible for another 3 out of the next 5. Now, that's a little bit better, because then you're only forcing people to go off for 2 years, and maybe all women can make it. But a lot of women have a hard time going off for 2 years. Again, if you have these multiple barriers, that's difficult. So anyway, I've come up with this is the one reform that's out there right now, which is very difficult to rationalize with the in-kind programs. Oh, I'm not going to belabor that. The in-kind programs refer to what economists call paternalism, and what they were contrasting that with the consumer. So if you've taken intermediate microeconomics, you know that the like number one thing you learn is the great thing about a market system is that consumers, there's consumer sovereignty in a market system. They can buy whatever they want, and they have preferences for what goods they like to buy. And the best thing, you know, great thing about the market economy is that they can maximize their utility and just choose the best bundle of goods they want. Well, in this kind of case, the government, the voters don't want to do that. They don't want to just give cash to poor families and let them spend it and have consumer sovereignty and spend it on what they want them to spend on specific goods. And it's pretty intuitive why that is. The interesting thing is some people proposed a much different system that we have, a really comprehensive one. We had a program for every important good, food, housing, clothing, medical care, education, child care, and everything else. Suppose you had like a dozen programs out there, and every one of them, you know, help families with a different, you know, program, I mean, a good, and that they added up to just about all the, you know, important goods. If you listed the top 12 budget items in a family's household budget, you know, the top 12 would probably take up 90% of what they do. So it's almost the same as giving them cash if you gave them all these different programs. And it's actually a nice kind of vision. You know, it's kind of an ideal vision of how an in-kind system could really help. And I think it's a very viable one, theoretically. The problem is out there right now, we are so far away from that. We don't have all these programs. They're very hard to access. And we have a long, long way to go before we have that kind of comprehensive in-kind system. Yeah?
But I got a question about that. Alan Greenspan thought that we were rational, you know, people, and that the market will regulate itself if you just let it go. I mean, can we do really the same assumption about us now that we know that we're not rational? Why don't we just give them cash, and instead of spending and giving food to their kids, they go and spend it on drugs?
Yeah, that's the argument, yeah. So, I think that a properly designed, the ideal in-kind system would be almost identical to cash. That's my own view. And so I'm very sympathetic to the traditional consumer sovereignty idea. And so I'm sympathetic to this. But my personal values, I'd be fine with cash. But I'm trying to figure out what. So this is a case where, though, I think you can make a rational. I'm just saying there's an economic model here which would support this. Some data, okay. So the last, I'm going to end up here. So I'm taking questions as we go along. I hope that's okay because we're going to run out of time. But I'm going to give you three, like only four graphs, not inundate you with data. This one is one you probably, is a modification of one in my paper, so you've probably already seen this. Here are the programs, that TANF program, the Earned Income Tax Credit, this SSI program for the disabled, and then our in-kind programs like for Medicare, food, and housing. And here are the billions of dollars we spend on those programs, about 40 years ago, 1970, and as recent as 2006. TANF, that cash program for single mothers, and this is real, this is adjusted for inflation in real dollars, has actually gone down. We spend less on single cash, that cash program, than we did 35, 40 years ago, which is really kind of unprecedented. Almost all programs grow a little bit over time. The EITC has gone from nothing to $45 billion. For those disabled, we spend $40 billion instead of $16 billion. On medical care, is the giant here. We spend $319 billion instead of $28 billion. Food programs, $31 billion instead of $3 billion. Housing, $39 billion. So you can see here, mammoth growth in a medical program in kind. And we'll spend, and the interesting thing is we will spend money on cash, the voters will spend money on cash, but only if it satisfies some other criterion. Yeah, we'll spend money on cash if it's for the disabled, because they are special, you know. We'll spend money on cash for the EITC if you're working out there, you know, like enough to earn, to get a good benefit from the EITC. If. We will not send cash on you if you're just poor, period, if that's the only thing you are. So that's what this table says. Mm-hmm.
For the Medicaid, as you're proposing that, the ideal in-kind system would be exactly like a cash system. But for Medicaid, you have such a variation in people that are using that and the amount of services they're accessing. And it's kind of like saying, the person that doesn't go to the doctor and the person that actually gets, HIV needs to be, some special needs, a Medicaid plan or something like that. How would a cash system kind of account for the fact that are using medical care in very different ways?
Well, yeah. I mean, Medicaid is the one where, the fact is all advanced countries have, health insurance programs. They don't just ignore them and let people have, make sure people have adequate income, that they can spend on health. And that's probably for the reason you say, which is such heterogeneity in people's medical needs, that some people are not going to have the income to cover their health problems, and other people will. So you'll probably always want, even if you were a real cash guy, you would probably want a Medicaid program. So there's also a literature, I think you were also referring to the fact that some of these are thought to be equivalent to cash, and that's true. Food, particularly of food stamps. The problem with the food stamp program is that the food benefits they give you are really low, and most people are already spending that money on food, even if they're not on food stamps. So if you're already spending, $100 a week on food, and the government comes along and says, I'm going to give you $50, for food, what are you going to do? You're going to spend $50 more on food? No. What you're going to do is, instead of spending $100 out of your own money, you're going to spend less out of your own money. I say, okay, I'll cut back on my own expenditure, and from 100, I'll go back to 75. I'll take that 25 and spend it on something else over here that I want, such as some clothing or something like that I really need. And you'll end up spending more on food, but you're taking some of that government money and spending it, siphoning it off to something else. It's called the substitution effect. You substitute some of that government money for spending on something else. So that's an issue with these in-kind programs. They don't always increase your ultimate consumption of that good as much as the government benefit. The last graphs here from another paper I've done, so this is not in any of your articles, but what a co-author and I did was, okay, we've had all these changes in welfare programs, and we saw those individual programs and how much, and I know in my head that TANF program that's gone down, that mainly went to the single moms. That EITC, that goes to a lot of different families. The SSI, that goes to the disabled. Let me, instead of looking at it that way, why don't I just go to the data and look at people of different types and just count up how much money every type of family is getting and how that's changed over time, and see who the winners and losers have been, or if everybody's been winners, or what. And what the first graph here shows is total expenditure over all the programs the government has, add them up all together. and break out the U.S. population into families that are really poor. The really poor are the people who are, can't get this thing to work. If the battery is dead or what. Okay, the really poor people, or this is 50%, half the poverty line, from having no income up to half the poverty line, 50%. These are the people who are still poor, so their income is less than 100%, but it's no smaller than 50%. So they're still poor, but they're better off, they're higher up than, sometimes we call these the kind of better off the, well, we don't have a good word for it actually. And then these people are above poverty, okay? And what you see is the total amount of bucks spent on people of really low income in the U.S. has gone up. And this is 1984, 1993, so over these 20 years, more money's been spent. So the government's not like it's being overall ungenerous. They're spending more on the poor, on the very, and they're spending more on these people who are a little bit higher up but still poor. So you might say, great, the government's gotten more generous. Yeah?
How do we know that there's been a shift from the guys who were here before when they're
Yeah, so I'll give you a reference to this paper if you want, where we show how there's been a shift from people from one category to the other in the income distribution itself. But there's still, you know, millions of people in these categories. So now this breaks it out by the type of family. How about elderly families? I haven't talked about the elderly, but the elderly are another one of those favorite groups out there that, you know, government seems to really think are in great need, and, you know, there are. The money for the very, very poor elderly families has really gone up. Okay, so the government, society has gotten much more generous. They're a favored group, even if they're very poor. And down here too, a little bit less, but but particularly for these very poor aged families, they're getting all kinds of money from the government, from all kinds of programs, and it's really gone up. What about the disabled families? That's up at the top here, the disabled. They're getting that SSA program that's gone up so much. Again, man, you know, huge increases in helping the disabled. So, you know, the voters like the disabled. They're a group they are sympathetic to. What about our single-parent families, those single moms here? That went up from 1884 to 1903, but after that TANF reform, bam, you know? And it's even lower in 1984 than it was 20 years. So this is adding up all the programs, adding up TANF, food stamps, everything. Medicaid is not in here, but because we didn't want, you don't really want to add that in and count that just the same as cash. But you add up all those other programs, and it's gone down. So what has gone up here, though, if you're a single mom and you're not at the bottom, but you're a little bit higher, now you've been favored. Why? Because the EITC, you know, is now paying money if you're a little bit higher up and you have some earnings and you're higher up in the income distribution. Or if you're on TANF and you're working out there, so you're making some money. So so the group that's been hurt is here. And so what's the bottom line? I have one more graph. There has been redistribution in the U.S. Okay, overall it's gone up. But there have been winners and losers. The winners are the disabled, the elderly, and any family with children who's above 50% of the poverty line. Who are the losers? The single parents, I didn't show the graph, but also two parents have been the same with, if you're below 50% of poverty, down, you know. So this shows this change in these preferences. I think it reflects preference redistribution, you can agree or disagree, between helping the people at the very bottom and helping those working families and other people who are just a little bit up in the income distribution. So I think those illustrate a lot of these points about what's been happening over time. Yeah. Go ahead. Yeah.
So it seems that there's a lot of charges on those who are unable to work for reasons like disabilities, being a single parent. Is there any conjecture on high funding programs that target those who are unskilled and out of the labor market instead of just keeping them in the poverty line?
Just to target that group in particular, you mean? Yeah. No, no. In fact, the government just doesn't do that. I mean, no, we never have. Particularly if you're a man, if you don't have any children, and you know, or if you're a man, you know, well, just basically say if you're childless, you don't get anything from anybody, really. Okay. Sorry, we're on over.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.